Yeah, it was interesting.
Well, they do have to put power in, so that was one of the big questions.
Good memories. Remember some states that you can't do that in your life for them, so.
So finally.
It was very like.
These guys finally able.
Customer satisfaction, you know, a lot of that. Whenever it came to those vehicles, these stories really are important. A battery.
Not certified.
And then it's on you, then you end up calling them like, hey, no, there's some tone.
You know.
You know, and then the name becomes an issue. Yeah, I was behind all of those phone calls.
You have to replace everything you probably paid to put in. And for matters upgrading.
It's interesting because the big, when I was there, I started with more than just a small fleet, it was starting. And they
kind of were required to change the budget.
Okay.
While I was there, was the, they had the large fleet.
It was.
Now it's reduced actually, back then, I think maybe 1,000 cars less.
Yeah.
It was interesting, but really what happened. Is that they learned the cars technically. I only think if you used it for ages, still doing things. But not like it was back then, it was far back. It's a culture was going on.
Yeah.
And I had a friend who lived in, or still in the body, and in a car.
Definitely, for inner city, it's like, those city guys, being able to get some city, having being back, peace of mind of that, and having the diversity of people.
From a left.
It's still, we don't pretty good. I just feel like it kind of changed a bit once they were acquired. They lost a bit of its mystique.
Where's the last one? Sorry.
Take them off sale. Now, what do you say?
So most phone is now down to two. One is usually in maintenance.
Morning, everyone. Morning, folks. We're going to get started. For those of you who I don't know, my name's Matt Hart. I'm CROG's executive director. And thank you so much for coming to today's workshop on EV charging stations. This is part of a series that CROG is sponsoring in order to promote these federal funding opportunities to the benefit of our municipal members. Bipartisan infrastructure law, obviously being a very significant source of that funding, but there are other sources too. So we're very pleased to have a couple of guest presenters here with us today. We've got Jacob Buckman here from Eversource, and we've got Joanna Hall and Sam Alpert from the firm of Weston and Sampson. A couple other things before we get started. Unfortunately, Elizabeth Sanderson, our colleague here at CROG, was not able to attend today. And she really put a lot of work into preparing for today's session. So we certainly appreciate her efforts. So I'm standing in for her. I certainly don't know the BIL and the federal funding opportunities as well as she does, but we'll give it our best effort to go over those. As you can see, we don't have a microphone here in the room, so we're going to do our best to project. If you can't hear us, if you're having trouble hearing, you know, feel free to move a little bit closer. We've got screens around the room, as you can see, so you should be able to readily follow the presentation. We will periodically stop to take questions. So we'll periodically stop to do that, and feel free to get refreshments at any point in time. So since you know, I think we've got a little bit of time together this morning, I do think it would be helpful if we could just quickly go around the room and introduce ourselves, and we'll give our guests a couple more minutes to just talk about their work and what they do with their respective organizations. So thank you all so much for coming, and really looking forward to a good session today. Jacob?
Great, thanks so much. So I'll introduce myself first, and we'll just...
We're going to go around the table, and then we'll kick things off with you.
So Jake Buckman, I'm a program manager for electric mobility at Eversource. My primary role right now is ensuring that we're meeting all of our port installation goals that we have. So we have, and I'll get into detail on the program itself, but we have internal goals that we track inside the company, as well as we have large goals that we're meeting for the state to show that the incentives that we're sending out are being used appropriately and are actually building out the electric vehicle infrastructure required to meet our various state goals and federal goals that we have.
All right, thank you. Hi, everyone. Good morning. Joanna Hall from Weston and Sampson. I'm a team leader at Weston and Sampson that works on all energy related projects, renewable energy, energy efficiency, and EV charging stations. We help municipalities and private clients with planning, implementation of EV charging. We serve as a liaison between customers and utilities, Eversource and National Grid, helping clients certainly to obtain grant funding or other funding that may be available to help support implementation of EV charging stations, and happy to be here this morning to talk with all of you. So thank you for having us.
Hi, I'm Sam Alpert. I'm also with Weston Sampson. I'm a technical specialist. I work mostly with electric vehicle charging stations, as well as energy efficiency and renewable energy type projects, fleet assessments, things like that, helping to help buildings and customers save energy. Work with Joanna and the team, and happy to be here to talk to you about electric vehicles.
Hey, everyone. Good morning. Jael Polanco here. I am Jake's counterpart over in Connecticut Electric Mobility for Eversource. And same goals as Jake mentioned, but some of the things I'm currently working on is aggregation of all the charge stations within our program and analyzing that information and understanding patterns, behaviors, just to help improve our program and operate more efficiently.
David Porter, town manager in Marlboro.
Hey, Roger Cron, transportation engineer here at CROG, and getting involved with our LOTSET program, and heavy emphasis right now on our Safe Streets program, and also support Elizabeth on a lot of our funding opportunities that that we're seeking for our towns and our region.
Garrett Daigle, assistant town planner in the town of Farmington.
Barbara Buddington, CROG.
Good morning. You said Marl, City of the Hartford, DPW, Heavy Facility Manager.
Steve Attic, Deputy Development Director, Town of East Hartford.
John Collins, Town of Ellington, Assistant Town Planner.
Matt Childers, Town of Bloomfield, Lead Building Maintainer.
Patrice Carson, I'm the Director of Community Development for the Town of Bolton.
Good morning. My name is Ray Harris. I work for the town of Simsbury in the Department of Public Works.
Rob Eloise, Director of Transportation, CROG.
Karen Ransoms, Deputy Director of Transportation Planning at CROG.
I'm Caitlin Palmer, Director of Regional Planning and Development at CROG.
Chris Zavidio, Town Engineer for Norrington.
And Ron Nolt, Luke's Consulting Engineers.
Excellent. Well, looks like we got a great group here today, and really looking forward to today's conversation. So
great.
Jacob, or Jake, as you prefer, you're leading off.
Okay.
So we just introduced ourselves. That's our agenda. There we go.
Let's hop into the Connecticut Electric Vehicle Charging Program. So my slide deck is all based around a PURA-approved incentive program to install. The one that I'm going to be talking about primarily today is the Commercial and Industrial Program. We have a commercial industrial program as well as a residential program. I can always follow up if anyone has any questions about that later in terms of, you know, if you need more education materials for residents or things along those lines. I'm happy to get to it either at the question and answer at the end or afterwards. So the program that we implement my Jael and myself that we're implementing is a 9-year program. It's set to go through 2030. It's broken out into three-year phases, and the intention of those phases are to, number one, bucket the funding that we have to implement the program, as well as give opportunities to iterate and improve the program across the duration of these 9 years. So the program started in 2022. We are entering the third year of our first 3-year phase. So we are getting into kind of our first big inflection point to see, you know, what are the major areas where we can improve it, as well as just being able to kind of put a flag in the ground as to our performance over these past 3 years. So what is it? You know, what is this program? Just to level set everyone, charging station information, you have level 1, level 2, level 3. This program is only for level 2 and level 3 chargers. Level 3 chargers are also known as DC fast chargers or DCFC. Level 1 chargers, this is essentially just an outlet. You know, you have 120 volt outlets all over this room. You can charge an electric vehicle off of a wall outlet. It's just extremely slow. As I've listed up here, it's roughly 5 miles of range for every hour of charge. So it would take a very long time, but it is doable. Every car has a built-in capacity to monitor, you know, how much electricity is coming into it to actually charge the battery. This is what you see in more in a lot of shopping centers. They are a faster charge than the 120 volt level ones. They provide, you know, between 20 and 60 miles of range per hour of charge. That's really determined by the model and how much electricity is actually flowing through that model of level 2 charger. So you can have kind of, you know, low or high voltage level 2 chargers to meet those different requirements. And then lastly, you have your 480 volt DC fast chargers. Those provide the most range to a vehicle for an hour of charge. It's anywhere between 60 and 100 miles. And, you know, just to give a little more information for each of these categories, level 2, the level 3 chargers, we're learning more and more, you know, every month that goes by in terms of how they're being installed, what applications are meeting the different customer needs the best. For DC fast chargers, we're seeing more of a trend towards higher power DC fast chargers. So things that are anywhere between 100 kilowatts to 150 is kind of where our incentive program is seeing the most demand. And then for the level twos, it's also a similar application for places that have public or destination charging. They're looking for higher levels or faster charges in situations like multi-unit dwelling, which is one part of our program. That's not always necessary, nor is it always the best application of the higher voltage level twos, since those are also residential areas. The lower level twos can also kind of meet the need. So the program itself, this is an incentive program. So how it breaks out and is into two location territory types. So you have underserved and you have baseline territories and different incentive amounts for each of those areas. For the level two projects, you can obtain up to $20,000 per site for a baseline, up to $40,000 for an underserved. And then for DC fast chargers, it's up to $150,000 per site and up to $250,000 in underserved. And then you can see as you make your way across the chart, we have different property types. You have multifamily, public, workplace, and then you also have the port installation requirement. So that's the minimum number of plugs that have to be installed at a site in order to obtain or be qualified for the incentive.
Excuse me, Jake, will yeah. we be able to get this PowerPoint after?
Certainly. And so, you know, keys here. One of the things that's really important is we have this as a per site incentive. So if you are in a situation where you have a parking garage and there are multiple levels to the parking garage, that site incentive can be applied to each level of that parking garage because it's a separate area. And in most cases, they have separate panels for each of those levels. Similarly, for let's say if this is going in a town hall where there's like maybe a public lot in the front, in the back, so like a north and a south lot, each of those areas would be considered different sites as long as they are being fed by separate panels. And so you could again obtain up to 20,000 or 40,000 for each of those individual parking areas. Lastly, and this will be in the slide deck, we'll make sure it gets emailed out later. There's a link to the underserved communities map. This is a website through DEEP. You can essentially, if you're not sure, if maybe you just have census tracts in your town and you want to verify that a location is underserved or not, you can always just put it in the address lookup that's through that link. Okay, so now we've kind of talked through the program, the types of chargers, the incentive, how are you actually eligible and able to participate. The first thing that you have to do before you even, you know, consider breaking ground is a charger. And the charger will have to be selected from our qualified product list. So we vet vendors and we have them send applications into us to be on our qualified product list. Our team, in coordination with UI, review each of these products to make sure that it meets all the environmental constraints that we have for humidity, heat, and cold, as well as all of our data requirements. So capacity to, give charging data back to us because it's a regulatory requirement that we have to give that to PURA. And then for the actual costs. So it's broken out into two categories of what you can apply those incentives towards. The chargers, which is up to 50% of the cost of the chargers, and then up to 100% of the make-ready costs, which include future-proofing. Future-proofing, simply put, is just laying additional conduit and doing additional trenching for chargers that you don't plan to install at the time when you're doing the initial project build-out, but you know at a future date, you'll want to put additional chargers in. So you essentially have the infrastructure ready to go, and all you have to do is put on a pad, or if you want to have pads and just add chargers later, you do so. One small note here, this incentive can only be used once per location. So if you were to do an installation this year and then in 6 years want to upgrade the chargers or add additional chargers to an existing bank, if you've already applied and received incentives for that location, you will not be eligible to kind of go back to the well for additional funds. All right, so going in a little bit deeper in what are, make-ready costs, what other costs would be needed to be picked up by the customers. So make-ready are all of the infrastructure costs. So it's your conduit and trenching, it's increasing the size of the panels, it's adding new or upgraded services to accommodate the increased electric load. It's also, the pads, it's the physical labor of the team installing them, as well as any permitting, site design, engineering work required in order to scope out and actually install the project. So these costs are up to 100% paid for by Eversource or UI, and any additional costs over the total project costs are would be picked up by the customer. So I'll get into it's just some hypothetical examples in the next slide to break that out further. So we rebate up to half the cost of the chargers, so whether that's the level 2 or the DC fast chargers. And then finally, there are a number of costs paid for by the customer, so that includes signs, the bollards that would have to go in front of the electric vehicle service equipment to protect them, Network fees are something that are really important. I really wanted to take a moment to highlight. So if you imagine you have a level two charger, you have the physical hardware, right? The actual charge station itself that is supplying the electricity to the car. But behind that, you have software that's actually running the charging station. It is the software is what you interact with to set the cost per charge, as well as view the usage at that charge station. In order to in order to have that physical equipment running, you need software behind it to keep it working, as well as let you know, a lot of the network services that are available have different abilities to spot failures, whether it's like connection failures or physical failures sometimes as well. And that requires an annual fee in order to pay for that ongoing service. That ongoing service is required for 5 years after you install the charge station per our terms and conditions. That's a pure requirement because, again, we aren't looking to just install these chargers and forget about them. We want to install the chargers, obtain charging data so we can make informed decisions with the state on where are these chargers being utilized the best, what different rate structures work best for customers for the various location types that they're being installed at. And so that's what goes into the 5-year data requirement that PURA has that would be required for customers to pay. Of course, any other maintenance fees that there are lots of different models for maintenance, whether it's through contractor teams or through vendor agreements that you could have with those charge stations. So there's a lot of options there. And then any other related warranties. So getting into, like I mentioned, a couple examples, we'll just keep the numbers all rounded, but from a practical standpoint, how could a couple of these different situations play out? So the first one is a location in New Haven. So that's a baseline community. It is a multifamily property type. So what that means is a minimum of 2 ports would have to be installed. As you make your way across, you have the cost of the chargers is $10,000. Also $10,000. Now, that brings a total project cost to $20,000, and that is, the incentives for this situation are $20,000 as well, but I have to remember that we only rebate up to half the cost of the chargers, so that's why the total proposed rebate is only $15,000, and the net cost to the customer would be $5,000. A note on the DC fast chargers. Actually, I'll wait till I get to that. I think I have a slide. Here we go.
Can I ask the question that $5,000 does not include the customer networking fees and maintenance, right? This is just the...
That's correct. That would just be for the project, the upfront project costs. And, I appreciate you mentioning that because there are different network service providers. They're also listed on our qualified product list. So it is on the customer to decide, which one they want to go with. There are different pricing models for the various network service providers. So you do have options and what you think is the right selection for your application. And then actually getting into the process. So I mentioned earlier, the very first thing you have to do is kind of select from the qualified product list, as well as finding a contractor or working with electricians, engineers to scope out the project. Once the project's scoped out, then you apply for the rebates. So we have an application processing team that receives, reviews, approves, or if they're denying the project, they'll give feedback as to what other information they would need in order to approve it. And then ultimately what you get before you break ground is an incentive reservation letter. That letter just lets you know that, this is a binding thing that, you will be receiving, you have your spot reserved to receive rebates when your project completes. We have currently, since we're in the second of our, the third year of this phase, we've already fully subscribed rebates to different property type areas. So multi-unit dwellings, we've completely subscribed all of the funds and we have a wait list right now, as well as the public destination charging is almost fully subscribed. And then our DC fast chargers are also fully subscribed. We do have roughly 700 ports worth of funds available for workplace charging and fleets. And so if you do have like a municipal fleet, there's a significant amount of funds available for that. And those funds do get refreshed every 3 years at a minimum, like I mentioned earlier. So at the beginning of each of the phases, all those funds are kind of started anew. And you know, for public destination charging, we expect at least 1,000 plugs will be available for rebates. So continuing to step through this process, after you get that reservation incentive letter, then you can go and start the project. You know that, you know, all the work that's in, you know, you can actually plan properly that the work that's being done can be rebated for, you know, the amount that we let you know in the letter. Once you've activated the chargers, then we have a payment request form, which requires things like a completed electrical inspection from the town, as well as an invoice of the work performed and a breakout of the chargers, their serial numbers, so we can connect to them and make sure that we see them on our end from data tracking purposes. And then finally, we'll send the reservation check in the mail, and that whole process from applying for the payment and then receiving the check takes anywhere between 10 to 15 business days. So we try to keep this process as tight as possible just to accommodate towns and customer needs. One last point here is our program is open enrollment. So for multi-unit charging, for public charging, workplace and fleets, you can apply at any time, even if the funds are fully subscribed to other projects, you can still be put on the wait list and we'll work it as soon as funds become available. We'll work that wait list from the top down, the first in line. The only thing that's different is our DC fast charging program. It is a very expensive program, and we've had so much demand from the first year that in the second year of the program, PURA directed us to have a scoring criteria in order to award incentives to those projects. So that competitive window was from March 15th to June 1st. And we had roughly 350 ports worth of applications, you know, sent to us, and we could only award 127. So it was very competitive. But you know, I definitely understand the need. And part of the intention of PURA is making sure that the chargers are being spread, especially DCFC chargers are being spread equitably across the state. So there is incentives, there's at least scoring incentives to the companies and the projects that are installing them and dispersing them across the state, because it's really, we understand how helpful it is for people to actually get around.
Jake, would you mind going over that parking lot example from the previous slide? Just the numbers. I think that's particularly relevant to our members.
Yeah, absolutely. The Bridgeport one?
Sure.
Yeah, so this is, like I mentioned earlier, when it comes to parking garages. So this is a six-level parking garage. They were looking to install, let's see here, six ports, level two. So they're just looking at three sites or three levels within that parking garage to install chargers, and it would be two ports per level. So the total cost of the chargers would be $30,000. The rest of the make-ready costs were estimated at $60,000. So the total project cost was $90,000 and the rebate was $75,000. So how that kind of happened is if you have three sites, three level two sites, let's see here. Oh, I think that the numbers, I think I did the numbers wrong on this one. So that this would be a better example if I did my math correctly, but that's why. So this it can be tricky sometimes. So the most critical thing to start with from left to right is the underserved location. So this means that per site or for each level of this garage, the customer would be able to receive up to $40,000 for each of those sites. And so although they could receive up to $120,000 for the entirety of this project in rebates, their maximum rebate would only be $75,000 because they still at the end of the day would have to pay for half the cost of the chargers. The general requirement to cover up to half was something set by PURA just to make sure that customers, contractors, property owners are investing some of their own funds in order to be more diligent and take care of these installations properly to incentivize that. One important note here as well, let's say, for example, the total cost of that same project was $150,000 instead, and the incentives wouldn't cover the whole thing. It is up to the customer to decide how the incentives are, what they're going towards. So if they want to put all of the money towards the installation costs and none towards the cost of the chargers, that's at the customer's discretion. And the vice versa is the same. If their total rebate is relatively small and it only covers up to half the cost of the chargers, it makes no difference to the utility how the customer wants to allocate those funds.
Thanks for covering that.
Mm-hmm. All right, so some final FYIs, kind of winding it down here. We don't have an approved contractor list. It is open to customer choice entirely. We have something called an EV rate rider. So this essentially eliminates the demand charges for electric supply to electric vehicles. That's the intention and how we are ensuring that. Now we're able to actually have customers sign up to that program is when you have a separate meter that is only supplying electricity to electric vehicles. So this is definitely something, pretty advantageous program to participate in. Demand charge may be really high because when a vehicle gets plugged in, it really spikes in terms of the draw at a particular location, and that can really impact demand charges, especially when you're looking at DC fast chargers. So that's a great program, and it's, I think it's also really important if you're being forward thinking about, maybe even if all you can afford is two or four ports, but you can also get a separate meter for those chargers, having that separate meter service available for future ports, I think is definitely going to be to your advantage. Like I mentioned earlier, the application turnaround time is roughly 10 to 15 business days. If you don't have enough service at the site to accommodate those chargers, I have links for the Eversource territory to our form in order to get that ball rolling and working with these service engineers. And then just a final note on charging pricing models. So when you're working with your network service provider after the charging station is installed and you're configuring them to work how you want, you can select from a bevy of options, whether it is just considered an amenity and it's free charge, or if it's a pay-as-you-go and the customer is paying exactly whatever the electricity rate is at that moment, or if you want to have it like a subscription fee where on a monthly basis the customer is paying a flat rate, and all those pricing models are acceptable, and that's all things that you would work out with the network service provider when you're commissioning and turning those chargers online. All right, and then contact information here. And again, these will all be available after the presentation. I'm happy to take a couple questions now before I hand it off to Joanne and Sam. Yeah, go.
Yeah, you mentioned maximums per site, and then it looked like in the Bridgeport garage there were three sites. What constitutes a site?
Yeah, so a site is a separate parking area. So that can be a little bit nuanced at times. There are different, but the essentially what it boils down to is a separate site will have its own panel servicing the electric vehicles, and it will have either some physical barrier disconnecting it from another parking area or a large distance. So, for example, if you had like a hotel with different Cardinal parking lots that you couldn't access, you know, one to the next, you'd have like a north, west, you know, east and south lot. Each of those would be separate parking areas, and that's one part of qualifying as a separate site. They would also need a separate panel servicing each of those separate sites in order to be available to qualify for a separate site incentive. Parking also easy examples because each level is separate from the first, or, you know, the one below it. And as long as that level has its own electric panel that can service that area, that would meet the site incentive criteria as well. The more difficult ones are if there is a, you know, a large distance. So let's say you have a shopping center and there are chargers at the face of the building and chargers at the back of the lot. You know, there's sometimes 200 to 300 feet between those two charging stations. And again, as long as they're fed from separate panels, they could be considered as two physically separate sites.
And on the table, it looked like the majority of costs, it said hypothetical table.
Yeah.
But it sounded like these might have been real life kind of examples.
So some of them are drawn from it.
Wondering about the relative, like it sounds like most of the cost is covered. Are these representative of the actual installation costs kind of?
Or? Not always. It definitely varies. It is extremely site dependent. I'm sure Joanna and Sam will have a lot more information on that. I have seen many applications, especially on the multi-unit dwelling side, where all of the, you know, where they're installing chargers in front of, you know, multi-unit dwellings. The panel is maybe 20 feet from where the chargers are going in. So they're trenching, their material costs are all relatively low. And, you know, they fit within that $20,000 to $40,000, depending on the property, the location type incentive. But on the DC fast charger side, we've seen where a new pad transformer has to be installed. And, you know, DC fast charging chargers themselves, the hardware can go from $75,000 to $150,000 per charging station. And the total cost is in the quarter to a $500,000 range. And our $150,000 site incentive is helpful, but nowhere near covering it. So it definitely varies. It definitely varies.
And one more.
Sure. Please.
Maybe. So a lot of these examples tend to be, you know, destinations like parking garages or places of work or that. One thing that we're concerned about in the transportation sector is expansion of, you know, market penetration of EVs, so, and range anxiety for people that are traveling.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a NEVI program at the federal level to locate these things near interstate exits, correct, and things like that. And I would think the model for those type of stations would be more like a gas station where you're getting off the highway, you're trying to charge up to go to the, you know, to increase, yeah, your range. And that would be more, I'm presuming, a profit-based kind of a charging station. And is this eligible for that type of a facility, these incentives?
Certainly. Yeah. So gas stations, restaurants, anything that, you know, any place that a public person could just drive up to and plug their vehicle into would be considered a public or a destination charge. So, you know, that could be a town hall, that could be anywhere where there's not a physical gate, you know, closing off the charger for, you know, the main 12 hours of a day in a 7-day week. So we do, in our application, we actually do have the definition of public destination charging, but it is essentially any place that's not gated for the main business hours in a day.
Is that considered a commercial?
Say again, I'm sorry?
Is it considered a commercial use then?
Yeah, so that would be considered commercial use. The residential program is essentially for, only for chargers going into not only a single family home, but also if you have like a condominium or something along those lines where they have a deeded parking space or garage space where a level two charger would be installed. So the residential side is very narrow and the commercial side is quite broad when it comes to these charging installations. Yeah.
I have what I feel like is actually a pretty dumb question, but I'm going to ask it because I don't know. For the DCFC charging, mm-hmm. You mentioned that's commercial, not residential. If I have a regular car, like a regular EV car,
yeah,
that it charges. It's not like I can't use it on my hybrid or something like that.
Yeah, if you have a plug-in hybrid, I mean, you can use. You could use any charger as long as some. I would just slightly curb that with some electric vehicles have. Maybe they have different plug types, but in most cases, this will be going away over the next 5 to 10 years because there's a national standard now for plug types. But and there are some cars that can only accept up to certain levels of charge. So again, I wouldn't say that it is in broad brush strokes. You can plug any EV in anywhere, but in most cases, you can plug in EVs pretty much everywhere.
So these are all for personal vehicles. We're not talking like mid or heavy trucks.
Correct. This whole thing. Okay. Thank you for mentioning that. This is only a light duty vehicle program. So vehicles under 10,000 pounds. There is a docket for medium and heavy duty vehicles, but it's not been approved yet. And it just, we just had a meeting on it yesterday with our regulatory team as there is more interest in getting that program started. But we'll definitely have a lot more announcements and details to come when that gets approved. Yep.
So I think you mentioned on the DC fast chargers, you had like 300 applications and 127 are available. What about the level two
mm-hmm.
charger program? What's the supply availability?
So each of the categories have different kind of demands. So the multi-unit dwelling is been the most popular, which in terms of, if we're thinking about how are these chargers being used, I think a lot of the reporting coming back is, personal charging at home is really easy. Charging at home is really easy. And when you're driving somewhere, if you're going to be at a restaurant and you can just plug it in because you're going to be there for an hour is great. Or, highway charging that's really fast is also, those are some of the ideal cases. And so we've seen a lot of demand on the residential charging side for customers participating in that program. I mean, we've had, I think, over 3,000 people participate in the residential side. And then our multi-unit dwelling side is also the most popular on the CNI end outside of DCFC, where we have almost 2,000 ports worth of funds available, and those have been fully reserved over these past 2 years. That particular program, we've gone back to the state in our annual review this year to request that funding allotment be increased year over year by quite a significant amount. We won't know until the end of November what they decide, but we are open to customer demand and then communicating that to the regulators who are kind of allowing us to fund those different program segments.
So then, just to clarify
yep.
a little bit, so on the level three
mm-hmm.
fast chargers that you had an application period like from March to June, maybe.
Correct.
So on the level two chargers, do you have, is your ongoing application?
Ongoing, okay. Exactly. Ongoing, and if the segment that you do apply for funds to is, like I said, fully reserved, we will still accept your application and then just put you on the waitlist. And what the moment we do get funds, then we'll work from the top down on our waitlist. So I definitely highly suggest if you can wait for the funds, or if you need to wait for the funds, to still send in an application anyway and get on the waitlist.
And there's one more question. So the DOT is rolling out this NEVI program.
Yes.
Is this program that you're explaining right now going to be pretty much dovetailed into their program?
Absolutely. So the NEVI program, the way it's defined is, you know, within certain distance from highway corridors, as well as they have kilowatt requirements for the chargers being installed. It has to be above 150 kilowatts and above, and with the intention of supplying more electricity, faster charge for the vehicles on those travel corridors. Our DC FC program is essentially, you know, it covers a broader area of the state with still the intention to rapidly charge vehicles. But how it's defined is for each of the ports that's actually supplying the charge has to have a minimum of 50 kilowatts per plug up to 150 kilowatts. So, you know, the NEVI program kind of does all the really high capacity charging, and our program takes customers right up to the start of it. And so our programs are defined separately and required to not overlap. So either you can take advantage of our funds if it's a, you know, depending on the location type, and but if it is a larger installation that's on a highway corridor that's supplying a really high charge to vehicles, you'll more likely fall under the NEVI plan.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, just for more practice. So if I wanted to put a project at like the in an application to I get on the wait list at this point because the program's full up.
Mm-hmm.
Sometime next year you'll get more units, is what you're saying?
Not necessarily. So our funding is given at the beginning of the first year of a 3-year phase, and it's supposed to carry, you know, all 3 years. We are going into the final year of our first phase, so at a minimum, you know, we will have funds available in 2025. But the only asterisk to that is if you do apply and get on the wait list now, if a different project falls through, so if there's like a different public or destination project that doesn't happen for whatever reason, customer can't secure funding, or you know, they just couldn't wait, something along those lines, their reservation goes back to the bucket, and then we'll just apply it to the next person on the wait list.
So queue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And so just make sure. So it's a rebate, but we have to wait till our reservation is picked before we can spend the money.
Correct. And you'll be notified, you know, you'll be notified that you are on the wait list and that you're in the queue, and then you'll receive a notification when your reservation letter has been accepted, fully accepted, and you're ready to start the project.
Thanks.
Is there a timeline for when, once you get the reservation letter, the project has to be completed by, or?
Yes, you have 1 year from then. Now, of course, there are always exceptions. If there is a material delay, I mean, when the program first started, things like meter sockets and switch gears, which are just really critical pieces for these programs, for these installations, were on back order, and some of them still are. So when you do have constraints, or if things do come up, let's say if a funding source falls through, or if your board, you know, if a board decides that they, you know, change their mind on a project, or if a contractor doesn't work out, just let us know, and we'll work with you and figure out, you know, whether if you need an extension or if it makes more sense to just relinquish the reservation and apply back in the next cycle. Well, we can talk through those options.
Mm-hmm. Are there any limits to or rate controls for what the owner of the facility can charge each car per?
No, there's no rate controls, but, you know, we're getting the ideas. there's a couple of pieces of this, but one of the main ideas is there's increasing saturation of chargers in the market. And so when a customer goes onto the application on their phone to see, okay, where can I charge my vehicle? They'll also see the cost to charge at that location and nearby locations. So if something is, you know, egregiously high, they're, you know, likelihood is they're going to drive another half a mile to the next spot instead. For situations like multi-unit dwelling, where that might be an HOA, that would have to be sometimes they're collectively decided on. So it depends, but there are some kind of market checks in place to assist with that. You had a question?
Did I hear correctly that you still have roughly 700 level 2 ports available for places like libraries?
For workplace and fleet charging. So if you have like a town fleet of, you know, even if it's just, you know, 2 or 3 vehicles that are becoming, are turning electric, and you're looking to have, and you don't even need to have the vehicles, you know, on the site waiting for charging stations, but if that's, you know, part of your town plans, we can support that. I think we have, I mean, only 40 or 50 public level 2s, which would supply like your public library or town hall. We have about 40 or 50 of those chargers remaining in the bucket. But like I said, still apply even if they do get reserved, because, you know, it's maybe 10 to 20% of all of our level 2 applications do end up getting canceled for one reason or another, and then we just work our way down the list.
You also mentioned that there's only each site is only eligible once.
Yeah, each location. So if you had like the library, your town's library, they're only for the duration of this 9-year program, they're only eligible for these reservation or this incentive one time.
Is that? And I'm trying to think about like a public works department that has, you know, a fleet of vehicles, and
sure,
right now they might only have 1 or 2 light duty vehicles that would be fully served by some level 2 chargers, because they can charge them overnight. 5 years from now, 7 years from now, toward the end of this program,
right,
they might want a DC fast charger because they have larger vehicles, bigger batteries, and they're using them a lot more, and they don't have their old diesel trucks to sort of back it up. So would they be out of luck if they already used this program to install those level 2 chargers?
Sure. So a couple new nuances there, but the main one is if they were installed level 2 chargers tomorrow and in 5 years they needed more, yes, they would not be eligible in the future. And that is, you know, from a town planning perspective, that is something to consider. You know, how badly do we need, you know, how useful would these incentives be right now versus if, you know, in 3 to 5 years, you're going to be required to have, you know, to transition your fleet of vehicles, you know, transition another 20 of those 30 vehicles to electric. You know, it may make more sense to wait 3 to 5 years and capture the incentive at that time. Of course, there's a risk to that as well, that, you know, maybe everyone's demand goes up at that point in time, and workplace chargers, the funding for those is just much more competitive in the future. None of us really know, you know, but all I can say is, you know, you have to just kind of make the best judgment calls you can. In terms of the medium and heavy duty chargers and, you know, the additional hardware required to service those, we don't have a program for medium and heavy duty chargers and servicing medium and heavy duty vehicles yet. But when that does happen, which I'm very confident it will in the next, you know, 1 to 3 years, probably, we'll definitely have multiple campaigns and webinars and things like that, that we'll host to educate and get everyone up to speed on.
And if you have a good idea of how you want to, I guess, increase your amount of fleet or whatever the case may be, take advantage of the future proofing to make sure you have the infrastructure set up for that.
Yeah. So I'm going to hand it off to Joanna and Sam. And yeah, I'll be available at the end for any other questions and things like that. Thanks, everybody.
All right. Thank you, Jacob. So this is a brief agenda on what this portion of the presentation will cover. We're going to get into some more project type details on planning, permitting, construction. We will talk about user fees and costs a little bit. We'll talk about some specific siting considerations based on actual projects that Sam and I have worked on. Vendor tips to topics to consider when selecting a vendor. You know, we and Eversource as well are not promoting any one vendor over another. It's an open market, but we just hope to provide you with some helpful questions to maybe ask vendors as you're looking to select one, and then some lessons learned on actual projects. So moving ahead, Jake already presented a lot of this information on this table. He did a wonderful job. The only addition here is the communications and interface detail here. To clarify, the level one residential home charger really doesn't have any communication or software associated with that. It's not as complicated as a level two and a level three, which increase in complexity with network communications, you know, fancy user interface screens and software to track both usage and revenue. And it can get more complicated as you move up the levels. So that's the only thing I would add to this slide, aside from what Jake already presented. A little bit of an introduction to electric vehicles. Many of you probably already know this, but there are numerous environmental benefits associated with implementing electric vehicles as opposed to gas vehicles. Many of you may know that transportation is currently the largest sector for CO2 emissions. So having more electric vehicles on the road and infrastructure to support them will help to reduce overall emissions. And a fact here is that approximately 7,000 pounds of CO2 per electric vehicle could be saved each year for each EV that's put on the road. They have corresponding air quality and health benefits. That is actually a huge benefit to the public through implementation of EVs. And then cost savings. I know that this is one data point we pulled, average of $1,000 savings per year compared to fossil fuels. I know many people have felt a pinch of gas prices, and EVs would help to mitigate that. I do want to pause here. I'll go to the next slide to share this map. But in this room here, can we have a survey of how many people drive an electric vehicle or a hybrid vehicle? Is there anyone in this room? Okay, so a couple people. And I would say this is pretty typical of meetings that we have or presentations that we give, that there's a smaller number of people who currently drive EVs, but that's certainly expected to increase. This is just a overview map showing the current density of EV charging locations in New England and part of New York. And, you know, as you can see, the EV charging is concentrated in the more urban populated areas, but there is a good smattering over the whole map here of where you can find EV charging stations throughout New England and New York. Here we have some examples of installed EV charging stations, so showing some different configurations. That's the point of this. The one on the left here is a bus facility in Concord, Mass, where they have electric buses and they charge them here at this lot. The right hand photo is the Eversource headquarters located in Westwood, Massachusetts, where the EV charging stations are there paired with solar canopies. And I'll just mention for anyone that is thinking about this type of project, a solar project paired with EV is eligible for the investment tax credit, and municipalities are now eligible to take advantage of that as well. So that is a new development as of 2023, which is a huge benefit and bonus to municipalities who could potentially take advantage of that huge tax credit. So we wanted to share this slide as an example of how that could be done and what it could look like. This is just another installed EV charging station. It happens to be in Belmont, Massachusetts. This is a level three DCFC. So that's a fast charger there that, you know, if you, it should be available on the app to find charging station locations. And since it is a level three, you could potentially plug in there for about 20 minutes and get a full charge for your car and then be able to be on your way. So that's just another example we wanted to provide a you know, a range of project types in these slides to share the photos with you. Now I'll pass it to Sam to talk a little bit more about some detailed planning and the engineering that goes into a charging station design.
Thanks, Joanna. So this is just a layout of the sample parking lot. So you can see that there's a building up to the northwest, I guess, of that possible location. The reason why we're showing this is because you can kind of think about the planning earlier than when you're actually, you know, going to be selecting a contractor or installing a contractor, kind of just high level thinking and planning about where the potential locations are. Should they be closer to libraries? Should they be closer to public parking lots or in the parking lot? There's potential in larger cities for curbside charging. So really just thinking about the planning of that, you know, located to other, you know, driving lanes, you know, potentially bike lanes, things like that. You want to ideally be close to where the Eversource or UI infrastructure for electricity is, because that can lower your costs as well as the utilities costs and infrastructure requirements there. You also want to make sure that there's ADA accessible facilities. So for example, like a curb cut or walkways and crosswalks to help enable people of all, you know, able to use the facilities correctly. Consideration also with like frequency of use. So like if it's far from an urban area, you know, maybe it would make more sense to be on like one of those corridors where you're tapping into more than one possible like use, like for example near a commuter rail parking station or a train station, near a bus station, or other places where there might be people who are parking for a longer period of time, things like that. So this is just part of the planning process. And basically, there's different configurations. So when you're talking about accessible facilities, you can design, there's a couple different options of how to locate the striping so that you're you have enough spacing between the spaces and all that stuff. So this is another view of, this is an actual like plan of when you get a little bit further into the process. So when you submit an application to Eversource, the first thing you want to do is have the site plan, you know, as part of your application. But then after there's some sort of review, you might be able to, you know, either sketch up the drawing a little bit better or use CAD to design the system better and to identify the different components. So not only like where the charging stations are going to go, but you want to talk about like where the conduit is going to go, how you're going to be trenching it, where the setbacks are going to be, where the if there's a pad mount transformer, where that spot is going to be, and think about like where the trees are and located to that. And where other barriers might be, like fire hydrants or parking meters or other types of poles that could be either in the way or help also direct where you want your charging stations to be. So there's some good best practices on that. So when it comes to ADA design considerations, some of the things that we look at are the existing site conditions. So existing site conditions include the sidewalks, you know, located close or right next to a sidewalk. If it doesn't have a sidewalk, you might need to create a sidewalk. Crosswalks, like for example, if you need to cross a parking lot to get to a building, for example, and then local to like building entrance can be priority as well. So there's also, in addition, you know, you want to take into consideration if you are required to have an ADA accessible spot, you'll also need hash marks next to the space, which typically take up almost a full parking space. So you kind of want to plan for potentially taking away a parking space or moving the lines a little bit to accommodate. So standard ADA practice for striping is blue striping. So the paint should be blue. Standard EVs are typically green, and that's like a federal standard typically. And then the minimum combined space and aisle width. So that's with the hash marks as well as the parking space itself. You need about 16 feet minimum for that ADA accessible space.
All right, I'm going to talk about some general permitting requirements. To install an EV charging station, we have found that most of the time a building and electrical permit are needed, and that may be it. So that is not very onerous in terms of permitting requirements. However, I will mention that the local zoning bylaws should be checked and you should do a local zoning review. Some towns have town-specific permitting requirements. We found that many towns do not yet address EVs in their bylaws, and that's why only a building and electrical permit are required. In the future, that could change as more EV charging stations are installed. Some towns may impose additional permitting requirements, but right now, for the most part, it's pretty simple. With just a building and electrical permit, you would need to submit a plan, and as Sam showed some examples of, and then that should be approved. I'll also mention that Connecticut DOT has its own requirements, especially for the NEVI plan deployment that are going to be deployed along highways or within 1 mile of highways. And then Connecticut DEP should be just consulted with as well. If you're looking to do a new development, for example, if you're impacting wetland areas, if you're, you know, doing any kind of new site development, all of the permitting requirements associated with that site development would need to be followed. But if you have an existing parking lot and you're simply looking to install EV charging stations in an existing parking lot, building an electrical permit are really the only two permits that may be needed in that situation. So the conclusion is it's not too onerous in terms of permitting yet, which is good news.
So back to construction. So when you're getting into actual construction, after you go through some of the design and planning, submitting an application to Eversource or the local utility, getting some feedback on where the infrastructure is going to be. Once you get your incentive and grant approvals, construction. So in terms of the infrastructure, so you might think that the construction of a charging station is just, the station itself, right? Because that's all you can see. However, there's a significant portion of construction associated with the electrical infrastructure, depending on the project. So that's just something to consider. For example, you might need to dig some trenches to run some cables and electrical. You might need a pad on the ground next to the charging station or two, depending on the situation. You might need additional cabling. Sometimes you can connect to a pole or a riser, which doesn't necessarily have to have a pad mount transformer. However, a lot of situations do require the pad mounts. So again, you want to be as close as you can to the electric infrastructure to reduce those costs, but when you get into actual construction, that's the first thing you need to do. That's what's called the make ready process to the utility. And that enables you to install everything up to the actual pad, the pad, which is a concrete pad that you're gonna put your charging station on. So that's the first step. So once you're done with your infrastructure, there's obviously the utility needs to have their engineering involved in terms of acceptance of the plans and all that stuff. But once the construction is done with that, then you can start installing your charging station. And the charging station, there's electrical wiring, there's a physical station that gets installed, activation of the system. So that typically is like a remote activation through the manufacturer. Then there's commissioning, and that can be remote or that can be in person. There could be a technician representative of the manufacturer that's right there with the installer to help with that process and to make sure that it's working properly and all the voltages and charges are working correctly and communications and everything. So you want to make sure that that's all commissioned, working properly before you make it publicly accessible. And then after that, then you have some of the civil process. So you might have repaving of some of the spaces. There might be some regrassing and things like that of some of the spaces behind the charging station, painting the spaces, signs, and all that included. So it's not just the charging station that needs to be constructed.
Okay, and then next, we just have a high-level overview of user fees. I know this question had come up already. So user fees can range from free to what we've seen in general is the 20 cents per kilowatt hour to 40 cents per kilowatt hour. We kind of get this question a lot, you know, which fee should we charge for use of our charging station? And it depends on a number of factors specific to each owner or customer, but this is a typical cost range that we've seen. If the charge is per kilowatt hour, alternatively, you could charge per hour. We've seen fees in the range of $2 to $4 per hour. And then fees can also be imposed if you overstay your limit. So for example, in an urban setting, if people are doing curbside charging, they park their EV there overnight, and they incur a fee for charging, but then their car is fully charged and they are not moving it out of that spot to allow for somebody else to come in and park there. So we'll see fees imposed for overuse of the area. And these are just some options that you can consider if you're looking to install a charging station and you're wondering about fees. Where do I start? What are other people doing? Mention some general parameters that some EV charging owners use in their fee structure. So
are those for fast charging stations?
This would be, for example, for a level 2 charger. Right. Yeah, that's a good question. And then costs of the units themselves. Again, this is a very high level overview. Costs will vary per site, per project, and per charging station chosen for installation. But the infrastructure can range, $25,000 to $50,000. I think we've actually seen some that are in excess of $50,000. So $50,000 is not necessarily even the high limit of the make ready infrastructure, and that depends on the length of conduit, the distance from existing metering and infrastructure. And that, you know, that's what is in that make ready bucket, getting the site ready for a charging station. The equipment itself, I think Jake had already mentioned this, level 2 charging stations can range from $8,000 to $30,000 each. And then there's a huge jump between level 2 and level 3, which is, we have here $100,000 to $300,000. And again, that's a big range in itself. But level 3 equipment is certainly more expensive than level 2. And it's a big jump there. And then the installation cost, you do need an electrician to install the equipment, to do all the wiring. That's based on, labor rates and the equipment. But you need to add up these three cost items to really get your total project cost there. It's not just the charging station itself or the infrastructure itself. It's also the labor and the installation time that goes into installing all of that. So we just wanted to present this so people can be mindful of the total true cost of installing an EV charging station. But the incentives from the utilities absolutely help. So don't let this scare you away. Yes.
And that doesn't include things like if you need the software.
It doesn't include that. That would all be additional as well. Very good point. Yep. The software, your O&M, your long-term contract with that kind of item would be in addition to this. All right.
So as Joanna mentioned earlier, so these are things that you want to think about when you're looking at different vendor options. So like different manufacturer options, different networking options, et cetera. Talking about networking, there's a whole variety of different types that I think Jay went into a little bit earlier. Two-way metering, so that's something that's up and coming, and utilities are going to want to take advantage of that more and more. So it's possible that they may be incentivized for to allow two-way metering charging stations that, for example, might allow vehicles to act as like a storage for their demand response system. So that could be something in the future to watch out for as like a feature that both the manufacturers as well as the networking capabilities
kind of research on that. Yeah, so like two-way metering, another term for it might be like vehicle to grid. So it's the idea that like a vehicle could then supply electricity back to the grid in a similar way that solar panels, you know, also feed the grid that are on like a residential home.
Mm-hmm. So it's less common right now for systems that are available, but it's something to watch out for the future in the next couple of years. Solar tie-ins also, so that might be something you want to see if it's a possibility, especially if you're looking into potentially including solar in that space. As Joanna mentioned, there's investment tax credits available for stuff like that. And then commissioning is definitely something to look out for, especially when you're talking to manufacturers to see if they include their own form of commissioning as part of their cost, because the manufacturers really are the ones who have a lot of the most experience like around the country with these installations. It's the installers that a lot of them are new to the space because it's really an upcoming market, but the manufacturers, because they have the market share, they have a lot of experience actually, you know, making sure the systems are working, you know, correctly and all that stuff. So sometimes the commissioning might actually include training the installer, because the installer might be relatively new to the program, et cetera. And definitely look at warranties, because there's options of warranties. There's 3 years, 5 years, you know, if certain things are included, certain things aren't. So that's definitely something to consider when you're looking at different vendors. And some of the lessons learned just from the projects that we've been involved with. So early utility coordination is definitely key. So even through the planning process, especially if you're looking into like multiple charging stations, multiple locations, the earlier the better. The earlier you can talk to your utility account rep, Dr. Jake, you know, whoever your local utility rep is, that's the person you want to talk to, because they're going to know, is there infrastructure here? Is there going to be additional cost to you? Or, you know, what are the current, you know, eligible manufacturers and vendors and, you know, installers in the space? So, like, they're the ones that are going to know the space and the incentives and the timeline for potential either tie-ins or, you know, incentives and all that stuff. So the earlier, the better you can talk to them, reducing the delays down the road. Planning and zoning challenges. So if you are planning a installation in a zone that might not be appropriate for something like that, according to the city or local government, that might be something that you can think about ahead of time as well. So talking to the planning department, right, in your town, talking to the transportation division in your town. Those are all really important things to be involved with, as well as if there's other owners of the space or co-owners. You know, if it's a private owner or something like that, then, you know, all those considerations are good to.
Can I add to that?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one other thing just as a challenge from our side as implementing the program and implementing the incentive program is, you know, different towns have different zoning requirements, whether it's stamp drawings sometimes for site designs or not at all. Sometimes it could just be a Google Map satellite view with, you know, wire, like line drawings, like very simple line drawings describing the installation. The main challenge there is, you know, because there's inconsistency from town to town, some of the contractors that we've worked with haven't been able to give accurate costs to municipalities or to their customers, because it's not always obvious and clear until, you know, they've learned, you know, they've gone through it, what a different town would require in order to have an approved planning and zoning application. So, you know, In my ideal world, if it was possible to, that there was like a common simplified, you know, EV installation, and that could accommodate, you know, DC fast chargers and level two chargers, that would be great to have just as a standard. So then customers who are, you know, who are applying or are scoping out these projects have a better idea of what to expect in terms of like the total costs. The main, you know, the main kind of black eye that we've seen happen on this is a customer and a contractor will sign an agreement, sign a contract for a scope of work, and then the contractor will go submit the application and then find out that they need stamped architectural drawings, and then go back to the customer and say, sorry, we need another $2,000 in order to accommodate these additional costs. And that really can, you know, negatively impact those relationships. You know, and those are not always things that the customer is obviously, or the contractor is always aware of, because we don't expect them to be experts on each town's permitting and zoning regulations. It's just something to note that we've seen.
Brief question. Have you had any, has anybody had any concerns about safety issues regarding charging installations?
Yeah, in the beginning, there was, I think it was, there were more safety concerns until towns actually saw the way the installation happened. So, for example, we saw towns that required the fire department to be on site when it was being installed, because they were bucketing it under the same zone as a gas station being installed. And it's simply put, it's not, and it's much safer. You know, in talking with electricians that are used to doing these, you know, level two chargers, 240 volt level two chargers are of a similar vein of installing a dryer plug, right? It's not like it's an extremely intense installation, but I mean, you can talk to this more. Definitely changes when you get to DC fast chargers and the total infrastructure required for those, as even as well as higher level two chargers, higher capacity level two chargers.
Yeah, and on that note, there is potential issue with theft in certain areas, not necessarily the station itself, because that's a heavy unit, but the cord. Sometimes those are cut for copper. So just certain manufacturers have certain features with certain devices that are more proactively thinking theft, you know, protective for more urban areas.
Yep.
Such as retractable cords and things like that. They only deploy when in use. When not in use, they retract up into the unit, things like that. Yeah.
Any concern about the vehicle batteries that they're charging?
No. You know, in general, in terms of like fire hazards, those sort of things, electric vehicles are just on whole safer than internal combustion engines. And if you think about, you know, the fire hazard situation, your internal combustion engine is having thousands of explosions go off every second, right? That it's operating, and it's, you know, of course there's safety measures before it gets to the actual fuel tank, but you know, they are much more, you know, they are both combustible vehicles, but the, you know, the internal combustion engine, just from the data side of it, is more of a fire hazard than an electric vehicle.
Question about standardization, and if you could talk a little bit about state of the practice of the standardization of plugs, or, you know, I've heard stories from the past where there's installations for heavy vehicles and then the things are out of date, you know, very quickly. And also Tesla versus other cars, where all that stands right now and how to incorporate that into any designs, or where you see things stabilized and where you think see things still in flux.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, most recently, Tesla, Ford, GM have agreed on the national standard for plugs. So there was, you know, there has been competition around that in the past. Let's say J1772, or there are a number of different plug types. Just for clarity on the Eversource UI program, we do, that is a requirement for our qualified product list, that it has to have a J1772 plug type in order to be eligible to our program. So at least it's standardized from our end. And, you know, we will continue to, you know, accept and reflect whatever the national standards are going to be. And so at least from the plug side, you know, there's definitely consolidation happening among the big OEMs.
Is that what was recently announced, is that the Tesla standard was adopted?
Yes.
Is it just the plug?
Yes.
Not the station itself?
Not the station itself.
And so this, just for nomenclature, the station is the vertical stick-up.
Correct.
And each station typically has two charging ports?
Not always, but in most cases.
Are there additional points you wanted to cover in lessons learned?
Just a couple quick ones. So just to help avoid installation delays, I mean, anything can happen, but, you know, equipment has been one thing that has been a typical delay of past few years. Various different types of equipment, whether it comes to the infrastructure or the station itself. Delays with communication with the manufacturer, depending on where they're located and where their are, et cetera. And application programs, typically there's no delays with the application program. You just submit and get a approval relatively quickly. There might be a waiting list potentially with certain programs, but, you know, the programs are there to pay customers like us who want to actually install these things. And then equipment purchases, I think that was already mentioned, and scheduling. So just scheduling wise, you just want to make sure you're aware of the, you know, restrictions or anything regarding, you know, the construction that's going on and the steps that are going to need to be taken relative to the different construction components, you know, the infrastructure first, then the station itself. And just to kind of think about how long that's going to take, because it might even be a different installation contractor that does your infrastructure versus the actual station, potentially.
Yeah, and definitely letting know, you know, letting your, you know, the public know if it's a library, this, you know, giving them a heads up, the main parking lot's going to be unavailable for X period of time, or if it's a school that has to be, you know, that you want to have open for the fall, that you're just planning accordingly to accommodate those different installation timelines.
We had a farmer's market occurring in a parking lot where we were scheduled to install an EV charging station. We were going to do work that day, and then we were informed, oh, the town has a farmer's market every day. I forget what day of the week it was on this day, so you're going to have to come back another day. So just things like that, yeah. The summary of incentives, I mean, that was the main topic of Jake's presentation, and I know you're going to talk more about that as well, so we can skip over that. This is just a table of summarizing, trying to summarize the incentives available, but I know there's certainly going to be more discussion on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So why don't we talk about some of the federal and state funding opportunities, then we'll have like a final round of Q&A, and, you know, we've got ample time for that. So the first one we wanted to highlight here, and all this information is available on the CROG website. The first one we wanted to highlight is a federal program, this Reliability and Accessibility Accelerator Grant. And it's sponsored by Federal Highway. Up to $100 million nationwide, and the funds need to be used to repair or replace. So not new, repair or replace. Existing publicly accessible level 2 or the DC fast charging equipment that are broken or non-operational as of October 11th. And eligible applicants include the state DOTs and local governments, like all of our members. Applications are due by November 13th. And here's where you would apply online. So let's see if we can, I want to see if we can open this up and get into a little more detail with it. It's supposed to be one click, but. Hopefully we can read this okay. So that was the summary I just reviewed. So the analysis that has already been conducted here, there are 12 of these units, either at level 2 or the DC level within our region, that are considered to be temporarily unavailable and that are eligible for this source of funding. But I don't know if I can't remember if we have any of these towns in the room. Yeah, so we do have Ellington here. But here's the list of towns. Here's the list of towns. And then check this out. There's more information available here. This is hard to see, I know, but we've gone through the effort to identify all these stations, their exact location, as well as the owner and some contact information. So if you're from one of these communities and the property is privately owned and you want to reach out to them, you know, you've got the information to do so if you want to be proactive in that regard.
Sure.
I see at least one public one, right? For the city of Hartford. We got one at City Hall here. So, you know, we've already gone through this and mapped these out for your information. There's something else I wanted to point to here that's not available right now. And I think Joanna and Sam can probably comment on it as well, which we expect to come back next year. And that is this CFI discretionary program. So it's now closed. It's now closed for this year. I don't know if anybody here applied. Any towns? I'm not seeing any hands, but this is something keep an eye out for. What do we think, Roger? We might see this again next spring.
Typically it's a year after.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this came out in the spring of this year and I think closed in May or June. But this is a pretty neat program for charging and fueling infrastructure equipment, you know, and there are two categories, the community program and then the alternate fuel corridor program. And the community grants program, I thought, was particularly relevant for our members, as this is something that can be located on essentially any public facility. You know, it could be your parking lots, public schools, your parks, et cetera. The minimum award is $500,000, maximum award of $15 million. So definitely, those of you who are looking to implement this technology on a more comprehensive and robust fashion, keep an eye out for that opportunity next spring. Okay. So a couple of federal programs there. The state program, so this is part of utilizing the national NEVI funds here. And in Connecticut, our DOT is running this program. And for phase one, they've made approximately $15 million available statewide, but it's more specific than that. So these are really focused on building out fast charging stations in priority areas, what they've identified as priority areas. And I believe there are just two in our region, and I'll point those out in a minute. So the DOT did issue this LOI. So the LOI period is open, and applicants who are interested must submit their LOIs by November 9th. And the DOT does anticipate publishing its RFP early next calendar year. So this is limited right now in terms of its applicability. Let me open the link. So that's the summary information we just reviewed. So I think there are 11 locations statewide that have been identified right now. And there are two in Crog's region, one in Hartford, one out in Willington. And again, all this information's available on our website. Let me see if I can go to the link. And actually, the DOT's consultant, Fussin O'Neill, has already prepared this interactive map. So the way you can look at this here, we go to the Hartford location. So they've already mapped this out. So if you own a facility, an eligible facility within this geographic footprint here, you can apply for the program. So we've got this geographic footprint here in Hartford, and then one in Willington as well. Joanne and Sam, I'm not sure if there's any additional detail you'd want to provide on that.
One more thing I heard on the conference call about the program. They said that the priority areas are important, however, not excluding. And so if you wanted to apply from another area, that's okay, but you have to have an argument as why that area is better than others.
Okay. Everybody catch that caveat? All right, so again, all this info is available on our site. So that concludes our formal presentation. You know, what other questions, thoughts, comments do we have for any of our presenters?
I have a question.
Yes, Patrice.
Recent legislation now requires multifamily over a certain number of units in commercial to have EV station at least set up so that they can add the actual stations if they want to later, but as part of the building permit process, they have to wire it, let's just call it that.
Okay.
And I don't know if that's quite move ready or not. I don't know if that term is used. I'm presuming though, if you're not installing a station, you're not eligible for any of this funding, so that would all be on their own.
That would be correct. Do you know any, do you have any other details on either the name of the legislation or when it was published?
I can get it for you.
It's part of the governor's and the environmental.
It's a state legislation.
Caitlin, we should probably flag that.
I think it was October 1st.
Okay.
Okay.
But I'm not sure.
I know there's a bunch of referrals, I think, coming in about it.
If you give me a keep going, and then I might be able to find it before we end.
Sounds good.
All right, thank you for that, Patrice. We're gonna flag it. So we have a, and some of you participate in it. We've got a planning and development roundtable. We want to make sure we can share that information with our members there.
Mm-hmm. Matt, are you familiar with the grant program through DEP as the Volkswagen penalty grant, the Dieselgate grant, however you want to refer to it?
Just quite vaguely.
I have one of those.
Okay. Yeah. You want to expand on it, Chris?
Tell you what I know about it. My predecessor applied for it. Gary was very good about that sort of thing. He left me a lot of grants that I'm picking up the ball from. And this is one of them where we just got the award, I think, on my third week of employment. When it came from DEP, we're currently waiting for them to finish the contract. Apparently, it takes a very long time to write these contracts. But the big takeaway from this was we were working with Newington Electric for the grant and for the installation, and there's a 50-week delay on the switchgear.
Yeah.
So I can't order that until I've got the contract signed, but I have an expiration date on the grant that I'm going to have to ask for an extension because I won't have transformers and things by then.
And I think they'll respect that. I mean, like, so, for example, I work with April and, like, Newington Electric pretty often. There were multiple, like, towns, municipalities that were awarded the VW funds who applied to the Eversource incentive program early in 2022 and then just kind of said, hey, we aren't actually going to move forward until we find out about the VW grant. Sure. And those were all when announced this past summer.
Yep.
And like you mentioned, you know, contracts and then material delays are going to, you know, be out on top of that. Just for starters, if anyone else has been awarded the VW grant or know of other towns that are awarded, have an Eversource incentive, you know, we're at a minimum going to be honoring the window, the reservation window you have for VW. So you won't have to worry about, it's already automatically, that's one thing we automatically kind of updated on our end to recognize the full window that you have for VW to get the installation done. And I would imagine that you're not the only ones. I know for certain you're not the only ones experiencing the switchgear delays. And, you know, it's common to the point where, you know, we're consistently extending reservations to accommodate, you know, those material delays.
Now, the last correspondence I had from DEP was they're in the process of moving the money from VW into whatever bucket they got to put it into.
Okay.
And that's part of the reason why the contract hasn't been finalized, because they have to refer to whatever bucket they put the money into before they can give me the contract. So I can have my mayor sign it.
Got it. Understood. I appreciate the context. It's good to, it's always helpful for us to have better understanding of that on our end.
Yeah, well, I was ready to order this stuff and everybody said, hold it, not yet. Yeah. I mean, at least I could put the conduits in the ground, but I can't do that yet either, because if I buy the material before the grant's signed,
then I won't be eligible. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you for raising that, Chris. Other questions?
I have the answer. It's the Senate, it's Public Act 22-25, and it was part of the Clean Air Act.
Okay.
But it does require you know, a certain amount of readiness to a site if it meets certain qualifications, not for single family homes and not for multiple dwelling complexes under a certain amount.
Yeah, I wonder if it's like five and up. Five and up is what we were required from the city.
More than five.
Interesting.
Because we just put in a commercial project with six, and I don't think that was required.
Okay. Yeah, I'll follow up on that. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, I have a question as well. Unfortunately, I didn't touch on this. I didn't touch on the cost share for these federal and state programs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the typical split we're seeing on these BIL initiatives is 80-20 with a 20% local match.
Correct.
Do you know, can any of the Eversource grants be utilized or be applied towards the local match? Have you received that question?
So not, they can't be applied toward, okay. So you can use federal and state grants for projects. We have a requirement that up to whatever capacity we have control over, that we make sure projects are utilizing federal grants before state grants. And so, you know, how that would look in this situation, if it's an 80-20 split, if you apply to an Eversource program after a federal program, there is an order of operations in how the incentives are distributed and what will happen. And we just talked with Deep about this fairly recently, but what will happen is if you were receiving VW funds, for example, and you have an Eversource incentive, how it will go is after you receive the Eversource incentive, DEEP will then look at, okay, what total or proportion of the project was covered by Eversource incentives, and then they will, you know, add rebates up to 80% of the total project costs. So there will, the intention is not to ever fully fund the cost of projects, that there will always be a town or a customer cost at the end of it. And the state or agency that is representing the federal funds will kind of be the final arbiter to ensure that there's not an over, because the worst case scenario is that, you know, ratepayer funds are overpaying and you have, you know, a random customer getting paid money to install charging stations. So we do have checks and balances in place to make sure that doesn't happen.
All right, so that's something we should all know, you know, particularly for the more costly infrastructure like those level three fast charging units, you know, at least exploring that opportunity. Other questions? Caitlin.
I'm on the sort of the integrated solar one. So my very limited understanding of how this works. So the solar isn't being used to directly power the charger itself. It's going to the grid, but it's sort of just looked at as like a symbiotic kind of.
Co-located.
Yeah.
We could call it co-located. And that, thank you for asking that question, because a lot of people mistakenly think that the solar is powering the car, and that is not the case. They can just be co-located.
And maybe could you speak to a little bit about sort of like, obviously EVs, you know, they're better than cars, but there's the question, I think, about sort of the sustainability of sort of the whole process as far as like the energy generation and then the car and then the life cycle of the car and the battery. So like, and maybe that ties in a bit too. Maybe also I had a question about like sort of grid capacity in general. That's not really a question.
I mean, to rapid fire them. I mean, the total life cycle of a combustion vehicle, including construction, you know, through end of life compared to that of an EV, including construction of the EV, even with the rare earth minerals required and the, you know, the more intensive process to build the battery, is still 70% of the total environmental impacts of a combustion vehicle. So, and when you're looking at the entire life cycle, even knowing that the upfront environmental impacts to an EV are greater than that of a combustion vehicle right now, the total life cycle of that vehicle still has a smaller impact. We had an all hands at Eversource just 2 weeks ago, and you know, similar questions were coming up in regards to heat pumps. Because again, we're electrifying more of the grid, decarbonizing, you know, how buildings are being heated. And one of the questions that popped up was, well, you know, if the electricity being generated is with natural gas right now, you know, if we're electrifying the grid, you know, it's still being powered by a fossil fuel. What is the kind of the break point there in terms of overall efficiency? And, you know, with the exception of, you know, the coldest months, you know, for this is just talking about heat pumps, you know, with certain exemptions throughout the course of the year, it's still better than, you know, a diesel furnace in your home. And then similarly for electric vehicles, even if the way the electricity is being generated today is not ideal, you're still preparing overall transportation to be ready for, you know, renewable electric generation, as well as still, you know, what we're really trying to curb here, and the whole point of electrifying transportation is reducing the impacts of carbon emissions in higher populated areas as one of the, you know, the most impacted places. So, you know, the part of that trade-off is, you know, you have ideally less kids that have asthma just from being in a highly air polluted area. And so that's also, you know, that's also part of kind of what goes into, does it make sense? I don't know if you have any other thoughts to add to it.
All right. Other questions? Roger, and then Dave.
On that NEVI program, my understanding, Matt had up on the screen, there was a November like 9th date for a letter of interest, but I didn't go to the webinar. My understanding was that isn't required, but they're kind of encouraging that so that potential applicants would be prepared for the request for proposal that's coming out like in January or February or something like that. So I don't know if anybody has more information about that.
Yeah, so you have to submit the letter of intent as a, you know, potential applier to the RFP. You should be able to be eligible to be a bidder for the RFP.
All right, good.
So you have to submit that first step.
Thank you.
And you do not have to have a letter of support from the building owner or the landowner or anything like that. You know, that, but that is going to be required when you submit your RFP.
Okay.
So start thinking about that part.
Okay.
But you don't have to be a landowner to submit a letter of intent in that area.
I mean, you could be a city, you could be a municipality, you could be
planning to lease, right?
Yep.
Right.
A building owner, a gas station owner, you know, any of the above, frankly.
Thank you for raising that, Roger. David, you had a question as well?
You
alluded to a tax credit program for co-located solar and EV charging. How does that differ from tax credits available for solar and EV charging that may not be co-located? Is there a special program that kind of layers on top for co-locating?
No, so that's a great question. It's the same program that exists now, the investment tax credit, which is now back up to 30%.
Okay.
But the change is that was not previously available to municipalities to take advantage of, and it now is. So that's what the change is. And I'm saying if you install solar and EV, both components of that project are eligible for the investment tax credit. If you just install solar, that's eligible. And if you just install EV, that's eligible as well. But the bigger bang for your buck would be to do both together because it's such a high tax credit that you could take advantage of it for both aspects of the project combined. And then changes that it's now available to municipalities, whereas previously it was only available to the private entities. Yeah.
And then also you get all the benefits of sharing common infrastructure, right? When they're actually on top of each other, where you're not, you know, if they're in two separate areas, then you have a lot of additional trenching, conduit, potentially panels or metering that has to take place. Whereas when they're stacked on top of each other, they can share a lot of that and reduce costs.
Mm. Yeah, it's an intriguing model to think about for sure. Other questions? Caitlin. I wasn't sure if there was one further down.
I've got kind of another sort of amorphous question. I think, is there anything specific related to sort of the, maybe it's multifamily siting, and then maybe it's also relative specific to the Eversource incentive program? So I think you said it's also public, but then you also mentioned like HOAs as an example.
Mm-hmm.
And so just wondering, like, is it still a requirement that the multifamily siting is still publicly accessible? And I was also more generally curious too, throwing a lot at you. Are we seeing, I guess, for the Eversource program, them being located not in the underserved areas? Like, is that more targeted towards, or not targeted, but
advantage of all good questions. Places? So there is not a requirement for multi-unit dwelling installations to be publicly available. And you know, how does a customer actually interact with a publicly available charger? What does that actually look like? Well, let's say if you are, you have an application on your phone for Amped Up, which, you know, is a network of chargers. You almost think of it like a cell phone service area. You open up your app for Amped Up and you look for chargers that are available. The ones that are at a multi-unit dwelling are not required to be listed as publicly available charging stations, because the idea and the intent is that they're serving the residents, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the ones, like I mentioned earlier, are available, you know, those 12-hour chunks of business days are going to be listed as publicly available chargers that anyone could drive up to. In regards to, you know, baseline versus underserved communities, it's different for each of the industry sectors, but currently we've seen I'm trying to remember if it's which way the spread is. So we had it in our annual review, but I believe it is 60-40, where 60% of all of our applications are on the baseline side, and then 40% are in the underserved side. So it definitely has assisted in making sure that we're getting, you know, a more broad market penetration. But I'll confirm that.
Thank you, Caitlin. Other questions? All right. How about
a big... combine the investment tax credit with the Eversource program?
Yes.
Thank you for that.
No, that's okay. Good question.
Any others?
I'd just ask a general question, sort of like your opinions on, like, what are the biggest challenges to overcome in the next, I don't know, 5 years or so on EV adoption?
Yeah. I'm not as concerned about the EV adoption side. I mean, in terms of market trends of purchases of electric vehicles, you know, that is definitely, you know, it's been doubling every year essentially for the past 5 years. So I'm not as concerned from the, you know, f- from the individual wanting to purchase an EV.
Maybe this, yeah, the system.
Correct. Now, from like the infrastructure side, I think we're on the right track, and we're going to be learning, you know, Jael specifically is going to be learning a lot more over the next year or two in terms of how often are different chargers being used, how long they're being used for, you know, are there different rates or costs per charge types that are more attractive or less attractive to customers. So we'll learn a little bit more on that end if there's anything that's really acting as a roadblock. But from, you know, really from my perspective, as I'm seeing the infrastructure being built out and the challenges of it, permitting and zoning and supply chain are the two biggest issues we have. I've worked with multiple contractors who have been held up by permitting and zoning 6 to 8 months for a project because they're getting just kind of spoon-fed small changes that have to happen to their project, or, you know, they're not getting feedback for 2 to 3 months at a time. And then when they are, it's because they have to tweak their application and then wait for another month or two before they get feedback. So that is directly impacting how quickly the infrastructure is being installed. And then as well, you know, the supply chain, it's a bigger concern on the DC fast charger side because, you know, it's higher tech components required to accommodate them. But, you know, even from some of the larger level two installations that still require switch gears or new meter sockets, those are delayed, you know, sometimes 3 to 6 months or a year, depending on the component required.
Yeah, and when it comes to all that, in regards to like a pipeline status, we keep track of all of that to try to understand, you know, behaviors and the fulfillment of a project, for example. So if it's a supply chain, you know, related issue, or if it's a permitting and zoning, we're looking to find measures to intervene, right? For example, if there's a particular town that has more issues than others, then we'll leverage our ability to work with community relations internally to try to mitigate these issues.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, we've talked a lot about these charging stations, like in maybe public accessible areas, but I could see, what about from the standpoint of people just charging at home? And I could see a situation where ranges increase for vehicles that people, yep, are mainly charging at home. Are there incentive programs, or are there any barriers to folks installing other types of chargers at home? Or
sure.
What do you see for like land, are there any barriers and codes or regulations that
yeah, expected? On the residential side, we do have a residential incentive program. So we have, similarly on the residential side, a qualified product list where we will rebate $100 for each of those chargers. Those charger costs are, you know, anywhere between $600 to $1,000. So it's a significant incentive, you know, for our qualified product list chargers on the residential side, as well as $500 any wiring upgrades needed to install them. And then we also have a what's called managed charging program that customers can would also apply to and take part of, which essentially helps set up a charging time frame for their vehicle. So they, you know, they could come home at 5 o'clock at night, plug it in, but the charger wouldn't start charging your vehicle until 9 o'clock at night, where the cost to charge their vehicle would be lower. So there is a residential program, safe, you know, in regards to safety. Like I mentioned earlier, a residential level two charger is the same thing as just a dryer plug that's being installed. From the safety standpoint, you know, level two chargers could just have a dryer plug, or they can be wired directly to a panel. Being wired directly to the panel is typically the safer option, just because the amount of electricity that's passing through is pretty high for a long duration of time. And then overall, in terms of, you know, adoption on that end, if you have a Tesla and a Tesla charger is not currently on our residential level two qualified product list, you can still buy a Tesla charger. You would pay for that, you know, wholly out of pocket, but you can still obtain the $500 for the wiring upgrade, as well as participating in the managed charging program. So we're very flexible in terms of, you know, accommodating what customer vehicles, residential vehicles they have, and how they can participate.
How about one more question? Or we'll take two more. I think I see two hands.
Go ahead, ask it. Mine's the clarification.
Okay. David, did you have one?
My question was just about the charging standards, the J1772 versus the Tesla plugs. Did I hear correctly that you're currently requiring, in order to qualify for your incentives, a J1772? Is that correct? Am I saying that right? Plug. And if all of these manufacturers have, you know, over the next 2-3 years are switching to the other kind of plug, how easy or difficult, how costly is it to change the board on all of these chargers that we've installed?
Right. And I'm going to just, I don't have internet right now. I'll have to get back on terms of, you know, when the national plug standards rolling out, and I have to confirm, I can't remember off the top of my head if it is them moving to the J1772 or not. You know, currently when it comes to Tesla, they have what's called the Magic Dock, is their latest charge station, which accommodates the older Tesla models as well as the new plug standards. And it's, you know, we recently approved that particular port connection for our DC fast charger program. So there's no immediate concerns over, you know, connectivity or incompatibility with electric vehicles. And in most cases, you know, there are the costs are fairly relative depending on the type of vehicle you have, how old it is, and the connection type you're connecting to. But, you know, there are single piece adapters, you know, essentially to have your car be able to charge from, you know, multiple charger types if it doesn't immediately accommodate it. So the expectation isn't going to be, like my town hall just has this outdated plug type and I can't get a charge there. It's mostly, you know, especially it'll be mostly more on the EV owner and operators to say, oh, you know, I have an old EV and I have, you know, a universal plug adapter for my vehicle.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Good question. Jeez.
So last word on this Public Act 22-25, Section 5C, it starts on page 15 of 35. And it started in January. January 1st, 2023, a municipality shall require each new construction of a commercial building or multi-unit residential building with 30 or more designated parking spaces. So it's not by unit, it's by parking spaces.
Okay.
So if you have 30 or more parking spaces for cars or light-duty trucks, they have to include electrical vehicle charging infrastructure that's capable of supporting level 2 vehicle charging stations or direct current fast charging stations. So we have read that to mean you have to get everything but the actual charging station there. So if they decide to put that in, they could then put it in. But it is a requirement. And it's kind of interesting because the state is trying to do away with minimum parking requirements and all that. So I'm wondering how that conflicts a little bit.
Yeah.
But
yeah, you were reading that. I was wondering if it's based on the parking requirement or based on what's actually installed by the developer, though. So, like, obliterating them, the parking requirements wouldn't matter because they would still put in whatever they feel is necessary.
Yeah,
so, if you still hit that 30.
It says if they have 30, so it doesn't say whether they're required or not.
Yeah.
So, you know, a large multi unit complex is and a large commercial property is obviously going to have more than 30 spaces.
Hey, if we could dig into that a little more.
Enforce it, and it doesn't say what happens if you don't do that.
It doesn't
give it a definition of what infrastructure.
Right, and I don't believe it's zoning. Our building department feels it's under their purview as a building official that they would require the infrastructure to be there before a CO is issued on the property. So we're treating it through the building department, not zoning plan.
Not clear on there.
No, it's not.
All right. Well, how about a big round of applause for our presenters here today? Thank you so much, and thank all of you for attending today. We did record this session. We'll make it available, and we'll send out the presentations as well. So hope you all attend our next workshop in the series. Thank you.
Lots of job.
Thanks, Bill.
Right, we appreciate it.
Yes, it's not going anywhere. More and more.
No, I'm sure he doesn't.
I was chasing him for a long time too. I think you guys did a real alignment. Staying in the big house because of white.